Good morning. First up, your weekly digest of all the COVID. Gotta be done. But quick swig of strong coffee before this next bit, because the news trickled out that restrictions, lockdown, not ending any time soon. Did someone say April or whisper it? May? Nevertheless, when Professor Philip Nolan, chair of the Irish Epidemiological Modelling Advisory Group, joined Áine on yesterday's Morning Ireland, he did strike a note of optimism, albeit in a very minor key.
The good news, of course, is the improvement in the numbers. Is it safe to say at this stage that we're past the worst of the third wave, thanks to a huge public effort?
I think it is. I think if I have one message this morning, it is a message of hope and even some optimism, but also one of realism. So you're right, we've made extraordinary progress. We've gone from 6,500 cases a day to under 1,000 in a few weeks. We've gone from a 14-day instance of 1,500 per 100,000 to 300. We've gone from over 2,000 people in hospital to under 1,000. But I think Roland Lynn put it very well yesterday evening. Last week, by every indicator of the disease, we had more disease and more severe disease than any point in 2020. We're still a good 6 weeks away, at least, from getting case numbers down close to 100 per day. So we should be at, you know, 200 to 400 cases a day going into March. We should be approaching the middle to the end of March in the region of 100 to 200 cases a day.
And while the numbers are definitely getting better, he stressed the need to stay the course.
I mean, you know, my own daughter suggested she might pop in for dinner this week, and I had to say no. We haven't had a meal together since January, but I had to remind myself that now is not the time to do that. So that's all we're doing with that signal. We need to keep this up. We need to be careful. We need to check our natural tendency to relax a little bit, because the virus will exploit any relaxation that we indulge in the coming weeks.
And that exploitation might lead to reproduction, which we do not want. No Valentine's hugs here, please, or getting the teeth done in Tenerife. Because as we know, the virus has already gone and mutated into the UK identified variant, so far our dominant strain here. But are there more? On Wednesday's Morning Ireland, Rachel spoke to Dr. Gerald Barry, Assistant Professor of Virology at UCD, and he had a slightly pessimistic take on what might be lurking in the shadows.
As things stand, just 11 cases of the South African strain have been identified here, and I don't think there have been any cases of the Brazilian mutation. Should we be prepared for this to change?
Unfortunately, any reports of detection of these variants in the country are probably, I hate to say it, inaccurate, for the simple reason that our capacity to monitor in this country any new variants coming into the country is nowhere near sufficient to actually pick them up. So any reports of low numbers of variants, or reports that things have not been seen yet, is just that, they haven't been seen yet. They're not reports telling us that we don't have them here. And unfortunately, it's probably very likely that these other variants have had the opportunity to come in. We can't say for definite whether they are here or not, because we simply haven't really had the ability to check every case. But there's a high possibility that they have come in. And if they haven't come in already, they're probably going to reach us at some point. And I think it's incumbent on us as a country to really massively ramp up our surveillance systems to allow us to actually confidently say what we have in the country, so that we can, if and when those things are detected, actually clamp down on them as quickly as possible.
Eek. So if we think we don't have new variants, we're probably wrong. Well, Director of the National Virus Reference Laboratory and Chair of the NEFID Coronavirus Expert Advisory Group, Dr. Killian de Gascoigne, spoke to Clare and gave his view of that assessment.
I suppose it's difficult to have a system that's 100% effective at any point in time, but I think the systems we put in place are pretty robust. We've been doing whole genome sequencing since the start of the pandemic. We've sequenced over 1% of our viruses. Now, we want to get to between 5 and 10%. That's what ECDC and WHO would recommend. But in the course of that, of those sequences, we haven't identified any, I suppose, unexpected, say, the variants that were first reported in South Africa or from Brazil. Mm-hmm. In addition to, I suppose, the general surveillance or the background surveillance, the HSE would have put in place a targeted testing program for people returning from those jurisdictions over the Christmas period. So in those targeted settings, we have identified small numbers of the variant first reported in South Africa, which is numbers 11 at the moment, and we haven't identified any of the Brazilian variant. So is it possible that people have travelled from those jurisdictions, haven't come forward for testing? Of course, it's possible.
But lest we lose the will to live entirely, Dr. de Gascoigne said that data gathering is ongoing, both in the lab and real world settings. And so far, the predominant virus here is one that we can work with, or rather, work against.
So what was interesting from the AstraZeneca study in South Africa is that they were very open and came forward and said, well, actually, look, you know, these are real world data now. We're seeing this in a setting where the efficacy may not be great. But in an Irish context, our dominant strain now is the variant first reported in the UK, lineage B117. There's no evidence that that is not susceptible to the vaccines. So our priority here, firstly, should be to roll out our vaccines to protect our population. And then equally...
Well, given what you've said there now, we should be giving the AZ to the over 70s as well, just to get it in people's arms if it's working on the B117.
So yeah, no, it certainly will. And I think we do have that question of efficacy in the differing groups. So we have to sort of be careful about who exactly gets which vaccine at the moment. But you're right, it is effective. So if there were no other option, obviously you would certainly use it.
Dr. Killian de Gascoigne with Claire on Wednesday. And this week did see the World Health Organization approve the AstraZeneca vaccine for all ages. Nevertheless, the government here is sticking with the Moderna and Pfizer plan for the over 70s. On yesterday's News at One, Dr. Colm Henry, Chief Clinical Officer of the HSE, joined Brian Dobson. And while a rollout isn't a race...
You've mentioned the vaccination programmes in Israel, in the United Kingdom, and the evidence that's emerging from those. And in comparison with what's been happening in those countries, it seems very, very slow here, doesn't it? I mean, figures are suggesting around 1,000 first doses a day in this country. Scotland, we heard this week, has vaccinated, similar population to ours, 1 million people with their first dose.
Of course. And we in Ireland, as part of the EU, are going through the EU procurement, the EU administration on a pro rata basis of their vaccines. All I can tell you is we're dishing it out as quickly as we get it in. We have 241,000, at least, that's based on figures a few days ago, administered to date. And that's against 280,000 brought in. And of course, we have to keep that gap, that buffer, to make sure that we're able to continue. Yeah,
I mean, I think people accept that, for example, the UK had a head start on this, but Northern Ireland, close to 1 in 5 of the population there now, the adult population have received their first dose. We're what? Something like 1 in 25. We're a long way back.
We are, but as I say, as quickly as we're getting into this country, we're giving it out. At this point in time, about 5 in 100 people of the population have had a first vaccination. 1.7 per 100 are fully vaccinated.
Yeah, so we're on this slow train from Brussels, really. That's the problem, isn't it?
Well, this is not a sprint, it is a marathon. And we want to, in this country, we've decided a prioritisation is one that I think is based on sound clinical principles and based on our experience of this, how this virus most greatly affects different groups.
Dr. Colm Henry on yesterday's News at One. But with the issue of variants comes again the issue of quarantine, an argument so thrashed out at this point, it seems difficult to know what else to say. But on we shall go. Tánaiste the Leo Varadkar joined Sarah on Tuesday's Drive Time, and she put this to him regarding mandatory hotel quarantine.
You know, Tánaiste, the point has been made a couple of times over the last couple of weeks that the government was told by NPHET last May, it was May 9th last year, that this should be done. And they specifically said mandatory hotel quarantine as well, that rather than checking on people in their homes, because they said that was the greatest deterrent, and also that it was easier rather than trying to check on people in their homes. And they also said at that time the government should undertake the necessary work to allow for this to be done back in May. And yet here we are, you know, waiting for the legislation to be passed, looking into the legalities of it now, checking out how, you know, what hotels might be available or not. Has this government left us wide open by inaction?
No. We're going through a very difficult period in this pandemic at the moment. But if you compare us with our neighbourhoods, and it is important to compare us with our neighbourhood, which is Western Europe, you know, notwithstanding the tragedy of January, we still have one of the lowest mortality rates in Western Europe, probably only Norway and Denmark at this stage lower than us. Mm. We are making real progress getting through this third wave, and that wouldn't have happened had it not been for the sacrifice of the Irish people.
And Leo Varadkar talked about the difficulties that encountered last May.
First of all, the fact that it can never be fully effective in the way it is in other parts of the world because of the land border with Northern Ireland, which you can't really impose 14-day quarantine on. Then all the issues, the legal issues around our constitutional rights, our civil rights, our European rights, and then also all those practical issues that arise, you know, in terms of organising these centres.
So you found out about those last May then, and what was the decision then? To just leave it because it was too difficult?
A decision was taken at that point not to proceed. For the reasons that I've outlined, first of all of those difficulties which we're now trying to resolve, yeah. But also the fact that we were through the first wave. We certainly, at that point, yeah, and you know, even if you looked at public opinion at the time, the public opinion at the time was very strongly against additional restrictions. So, you know, things have changed.
Ooh, that they have. On Thursday's Morning Ireland, Áine spoke to Taoiseach Micheál Martin, and she too had some questions for government, particularly against the backdrop of our UK neighbours imposing strict travel restrictions.
A lot of opposition politicians have been very critical about, you know, that enough hasn't been done on border controls up to this. NPHET has been recommending tighter border controls and tighter restrictions and observation of people coming into the country last May and early in the winter. But we're only moving, it seems, when the UK government moves.
No, I think if you go back along when we came out of the first phase and through the summer months, the whole momentum moved towards a European traffic light system, which never quite got off the ground because of second wave. We had kept the numbers down in the second wave. I think the variant and the arrival of the variant has given an added momentum and importance to the issue of border controls. And border controls are important in terms of reducing the volume of variants and delaying variants coming into the country.
But if we'd done more sooner, the UK strain may not be, you know, the dominant strain it is at this point in time.
Well, I'm not so sure about that because I think in many respects the UK were forced out of the traps with their genomic sequencing, their very significant capacity.
It's just there. It didn't walk here, isn't that what Roisin Shorthill said?
Of course
said
it didn't walk here, of course. But I mean, the idea of, and I even now as we move into a mandatory quarantining situation, we've got to think beyond that too as a strategy. All countries do. Otherwise, in the medium to long term, we end up as prisoners in our own countries. And so that comes back to the global vaccination strategy, which is going to be key to resolving this, ultimately.
Taoiseach Micheál Martin on Thursday's Morning Ireland. Now, while keeping to the restrictions is very difficult, understatement, this next clip might just stop you in your tracks. On Liveline, Joe spoke to people with long COVID. No energy, pain, headaches. And with such a new virus, limited medical knowledge of how best to proceed. It was a very scary listen. Laura was one of the many callers who phoned Joe.
So, like, I was diagnosed in mid-September.
Yeah.
And at the start, I was fine, no problem. First couple of days, I live at home with my mum and dad, and I was cleaning the house for them, and then I just crashed and burned. I spent about a week just constantly sleeping, and then I got breathlessness, a really bad headache, and I ended up in hospital in mid-October for a week.
Yeah.
Unlike everybody else, I had the scans and stuff like that, and it all came back clear.
And
scary.
And is that your breathlessness I'm hearing now?
Yeah.
Laura?
So like when, like what Ruth was saying, spend a lot of time in bed and I'm okay. But as soon as I get up and move around or talk, my breathlessness goes. And then that rises my heart. Like I started the beta blockers the end of last week. And before that, my heart was getting up to into the 150s and that could be only standing for 10 or 15 seconds.
Which is exactly another...
And, like, I'm only 32. I've played soccer all my life and never smoked. And I'm like this.
Laura on Liveline. And here comes another clip to have you gripping the coffee cup, but for very different reasons. Brian O'Connell reported into Clare last Monday. He'd been on patrol with the Gardaí in Cork City at the weekend, and they had got a call to a house party.
Charlie, Charlie, 9-8 to control.
Charlie, Charlie, 9-8, go ahead.
Hello, lads.
Yeah, lads.
Gardaí.
Gardaí.
Four people staying here.
Yeah, so...
And are you a tenant here?
I'm a tenant here, yeah.
Do you want us to come in and to have a chat with these people? You can give us permission to come in. Thank you. Good. Hello. Boys, how's it going? Gardaí.
Yeah.
Just complaints of a host party?
Yeah.
Would you call the guards tonight?
I call the guards tonight, yeah.
On your housemates?
On my housemates.
So it was a party happening in your own house?
All the time, babe. Like, in the middle of level 5 lockdown especially, like, tis a bit... There's no mass, there's no respect. And that's my biggest issue with it. Do you know, there's some expectation when you know how to share that. There's going to be some bit of boundaries, like.
And obviously you can't choose who you live with. You're renting a room.
No, to be fair, the landlord's lovely. He tries his best, but...
And so you've obviously tried talking to your housemates.
Well, yeah. Calling the guards wasn't my first...
I can imagine.
Yeah, I've very much come down the stairs, been like, lads, it's level 5 lockdown, cop on. You know, I'm working in a shop. I'm helping old ladies with their shopping.
And we're talking about multiple people.
I mean, I came down here, oh my God, one night there was 20 people downstairs. I mean, the size of this place, like, and pushing past people, coughing up on you, and they're all drunk. And then what you got was, sorry, it won't happen again, we understand. Next night, party again. The very next night.
Well, listen, fair play to you. It can't have been an easy thing to do.
Well, yeah.
Charlie, 9-8 to control.
Charlie, 9-8,
boy. Yeah, control, you can clear us there from that house party. Fines to be issued there to the host and to the attendants there.
Roger, thank you for...
Can't imagine what the vibe was like in that house the next day.
Awkward breakfast the next morning.
I'd say awkward doesn't even begin to cover it. Pass the sugar? I don't think so. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now, if planet Earth is in a bit of a pickle, what say you we turn our attention to Mars? Because now we have five different spacecraft heading to that planet this month alone. Lucky Mars, eh? And on Thursday, Leo Enright joined Mary on Morning Ireland.
It's all happening around the red planet at the moment. Why so much activity right now?
Well, it really is breathtaking, Mary. The reason, of course, is, as we know, Mars goes round the Sun about twice as slowly as the Earth. So it takes 2 Mars years to get round the Sun. And so every 2 years, the Earth and Mars are lined up together in a way that you can start firing spaceships at it and get there in a reasonable time. What's amazing about this, of course, is that in the past, if you fired a spaceship at Mars, there was a very good chance you'd never hear from it again. The idea that already 2 countries, and it's only Thursday morning, don't forget, already 2 countries have successfully arrived at Mars this week is really quite jaw-dropping.
But why so many missions and why now was also on the mind of Ray when he spoke to Kevin Nolan, lecturer in physics at the Technological University of Dublin, on Monday.
The first rover was on Mars in the 70s, you know,
which is,
you know, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There's mad advances and then it's sort of nearly stand still for a long time.
Yeah, well, the thing is that the planet is unbelievably hard. It's probably one of the hardest planets ever to land on because it's way bigger than the moon and it has a tenuous atmosphere. So we've actually struggled, like, you know, in the early 70s and 80s, most of the probes there crashed. And indeed, Europe was supposed to send a rover this year, but they backed off for fears that it might crash. So they're launching theirs next year. So even Europe are getting in the game. We'll have an amazing rover in 2023 landing there. So you're right in as much as it's kind of stood still because it's so hard to land there. But when you look at Perseverance rover, it's got an artificially intelligent operating system. It can think for itself, work on its own. As I say, it's got an onboard helicopter to fly ahead. So technologically, it's amazing.
And if you're searching for something to look forward to, the Perseverance rover is the one to watch. Leo Enright has a time and a date.
8 o'clock in the evening Irish time next Thursday, the Perseverance rover will touch down on the surface of Mars inside Jezero crater. This is an old lake bed. Now, by old, I mean 3 billion years ago, there was a lake in this place. And this rover is going to start collecting rocks. They hope those rocks may contain evidence for life in that lake all those many billions of years ago. The rocks will be collected and stored. Then a European rover will go there in about 8 years' time, collect those rocks and bring them back to Earth. An extraordinary joint mission by Europe and the United States.
Leo Enright on Morning Ireland, and all of that is great. But to what end? Back to Ray and Kevin Nolan.
And the hope is that they will discover something that will point us to life on Mars billions of years ago.
Indeed. Well, you know, Mars was very like the Earth in the beginning. There were seas and oceans, and we even know those freshwater lakes, thick atmosphere, all the same surface activity that was going on Earth and gave rise to life here was happening on Mars. And then it's smaller, so it cooled out and froze that record in time. So we're now going basically, like, you know, ancient archaeologists to find what happened there then.
Yes.
But some people might even say there could be even microbial life there today. And there's a few suggestions of that.
And of course, it could tell us what might happen to us in the future. Far distant future.
Actually, you're absolutely right. Yeah, when we look at the likes of Mars, they are and Venus as well, they are cautionary tales about how badly planets can go wrong. And that feeds into the environmental question.
Ever so slightly doom-laden, but still. Owen McGee, author and presenter of How to Be Good with Money, joined Sarah and Cormac on Drive Time, and the focus was the rise in online shopping.
There was a bit of a barrier there for some people before where they kind of went, if I part with my money, like, I don't get anything straight away, and it takes a couple of days. And now they say they part with their money, and a couple of days later, the parcel arrives at the door, and they kind of feel, well, this works. That was handy. Mm-hmm. And you get people learning the little tricks around order two different sizes of the same thing and send one back afterwards. And all of these little tricks that people have got accustomed to because, as you say, they are emotionally spending. That's what they're doing. They kind of feel, oh, life is tough and it's really hard at the moment and I really just want to give myself a little lift me up. And shopping is one of the ways we do that. But
so
we have to be careful,
why not?
Sarah.
What you're describing there sounds eerily familiar to what might be going on in my house at the moment. And it's not just me either. There's a collective sort of gasp when the doorbell rings in our house in the morning and we all run to the door because that's the excitement of the day, you know, that the postman is arriving. What's so wrong with it? Or is there anything really wrong with it?
Owen said yes, there was. It was just too easy. You threw things into the bag and then you're broke. And he attributed this to a particular phenomenon. And if you listen very closely, you'll hear the sound of Sarah McInerney's eyebrows arching.
There is this thing, Sarah, I don't know if you've ever heard of it, called hick and click. So hick and click is, and it's I'm going to say typically so that I don't get completely destroyed, right? But it's typically women. At 9 o'clock.
Ah, this is absolute
dangerous territory now. Where are you going with this, Owen?
9 o'clock, Thursday evening, a little glass of wine, hick and click on your favourite website. One click, it's ordered, and in ordinary times, it's there for you for Friday afternoon for going out at the weekend.
I would like to apologise on behalf of all men in the country and on behalf of Owen McGee.
just to balance it up, actually, sorry, just to balance it up, when you look at men and women, men and women would argue over who spends more.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we spend the same. Men and women, men tend to buy little big things, like, sorry, less frequently big things like gas.
I cut him off, Sarah, there.
Save him from himself.
Owen, we lost you there for a second.
Just to try and get back in the good books of all the listeners, I think the bit I got cut off was men and women spend the same amount of money, okay? So women spend little and often, and men spend on big gadgets.
Ah, now he's ruined it.
Where are we going with this in terms of, where is it? My fear here is that these habits have now been created. And I do think that we need to just be much more conscious of how we're spending.
Yeah, I see someone tweeting here the programme saying, I bought a lead and harness for a cat. I didn't have a cat.
Oh, God.
Drive Time on Tuesday. On Sunday, Brendan spoke to actor and writer Ethan Hawke. His new book is called A Bright Ray of Darkness, and it features a character called William, an actor whose marriage disintegrates while he embarks on his Broadway debut.
And listen, in the book, William is obviously going through kind of a messy separation, and I guess his life is falling apart around that. I suppose you, around your divorce, you have spoken about how you did become quite depressed and became quite, I guess, disillusioned with things.
Yeah, exactly. And I think part of what the motivation of wanting to write this book is to, over the 10 years after my divorce, you know, one of the things that really helped build my self-esteem back up was work. And I think that's in a lot of ways the genesis. You know, I basically took 30 years of experience and tried to distill it into this fictional story of a bright ray of darkness. But that if you don't run away from your pain and stare into it, you can heal yourself. And that's what I wanted to write about. In a lot of ways, we all think when we're suffering, you know, that our problems are completely unique. And one of the interesting things about writing is you start to realize, like, wow, men and women breaking up, men and women fighting, men and women trying to raise kids and get along, all this is cliche stuff. All this is just ordinary, everyday problems.
Yeah.
And yes, the writer in me just didn't have anything interesting to say about them. What I might have had something interesting to say, or what I aspire to have something interesting or worth reading about, was how that might intersect with performance. That's an area in which my life has been unique, and I had something to say about it, I hoped.
Yeah. Isn't it funny? You said there about work saving you. Isn't it funny? We talk about our fathers and everything. Don't you think your father, even your grandfather, would have been proud of you that you've come to a place in your life where you're writing books about the redemptive power of work? That's not something either of us thought we'd be thinking 20 years ago, is it? But there you go.
No, that's nice of you to say. Yeah, I'd like to think that.
And much of this book and also Ethan Hawke's acting career has concerned being a father and childhood.
I've experienced divorce as a kid and as a parent. And so I've seen it from both angles. I've learned a lot about it. I love that line, the past doesn't go anywhere. It's not even the past. You know, like your own judgment about your own childhood keeps changing. Things that I thought I understood at 18, I understand much differently at 50.
Yeah. Were you scarred by your parents' divorce when you were so young?
Oh, scarred. Put such judgment on it. I was formed by it.
Okay.
I was made by it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, because scarred implies somebody did something wrong, which I just don't really believe anymore. We all wish we had a perfect, ideal childhood, the one that we imagine everybody else had, but we don't. We have the one that we got. And I happen to be lucky enough. I have very wonderful parents. They shaped me and they shaped me in positive ways and they shaped me in negative ways. And it's fascinating. I see it now as a parent. You know, there's certain things you do because you want to not do what your parents did, but we all have blind spots. You know, it's the things I'm worried that I'm going to do as a parent. Those are not the problems I have. The problems I have as a parent are the things I don't see.
Yeah.
And while the fictional character of William and Hawke himself find solace in acting, it's not quite that pure. Yes, it's all about the art, darling, but did the critics like it?
And sure, look, if they were good, it wasn't going to be enough for you anyway. And then if they're bad, they destroy you, presumably.
Exactly. It's always what it is. Yeah. And if they're really good, you turn into a giant pig-headed jerk. And if they're bad, then you cry and everybody's got to baby you. It's pathetic.
Yeah. In some ways, you see, we view, say, people like you and Hollywood actors and everything as thinking, okay, these people are super confident and have none of the kind of neurotic issues that a lot of us have. But like, it must be, you're setting yourself up there for a lifetime of desperate insecurity, are you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's some faulty gene in a human being that makes them want to step out in front of 1,000 of their brothers and sisters just to be judged. You know, I mean, you would never do that if you weren't hopelessly insecure.
Actor and writer Ethan Hawke with Brendan O'Connor. Now, while education and the Leaving Cert is still up in the air, this week did see the partial reopening of schools for pupils with additional needs. One such school was the Midwest School for the Deaf in Limerick. And as they were packing the school bag, Drive Time's John Cook spoke to 14-year-old Aaron and his mother Eleanor. Now, Aaron's living with cerebral palsy and is profoundly deaf, and his communication is mainly non-verbal.
We noticed his behaviour has changed. We've been dealing with a psychologist from school and at home to improve the situation. And I think going back, it's going to be a little bit challenging for him too, getting back into that routine again. But we are accepting it wholeheartedly, that's for sure.
Do you like school, Aaron?
Yeah.
You like art, don't you? Play with your friends?
Yeah.
Aaron, don't you? You're not laughing at your mum there, are you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Aaron, I love your PlayStation top. Do you play video games?
Yeah.
The games are upstairs.
Punching.
Punching? What's the game? Aaron's trying to tell me what game he likes here, Eleanor, I think. Do you know which one?
I couldn't tell you. He's into Jackie Chan. He's any kind of type of ninja games he absolutely loves. So
less time for gaming maybe when he goes back to school. But I know he said he's got friends there and he's looking forward to it as well.
Yeah.
And your hope, as you said, is that there won't be school closures like this again, or you can get back to some routine?
Oh, you know what? That's a question, isn't it? You know, really and truly, I think, though, with what's ahead of us, with the vaccines and all of that, I think it's going to be a process in opening schools going forward. And hopefully it will be the case. Yeah.
For today's relief, I think. You speak for the parents of Ireland in hoping this is the beginning of something good.
I think you can see the sense of relief in my face already. For sure, yeah, okay. Absolutely.
And Aaron looks happy too.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Aaron, and thank you very much, Eleanor.
Thanks very much, John.
Drive time with a little bit of good news on the school's front. Wine Tuberty is cleaning out the kitchen drawer. You know that one? Random keys, blue tack, broken candles.
The bottle openers, the beer opener, the mashed potato thing, wooden spoons, whisks. Yeah, the stuff that just put the butter or whatever.
Cute texts about the drawers of horror, the drawers of death. And then this rather magnificent contribution.
We call that Schrodinger's drawer. What you're looking for is both in there and not in there until you open it. Oh, that is the most Radio 1 text I've read this week. It's beautiful. It is so out there.
The bar has been raised. Oh, and just before we break, whatever happened to the snow? But, I hear you say there was snow. Was there, though? Here's John Kenny.
It's not snowing in Dublin. It's not snowing anywhere. And this is the Classic Rock Hour.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. Are you all ready to get mushy tomorrow for Valentine's? Hearts and flowers. Yeah. Now, love is lovely and all that. But love gone awry? Now, that's one we can all identify with. On Culture File, Rob Long was musing on the slick dialogue of movies versus the inarticulate grunts and grimaces of real life. And he remembered an ex and a wedding.
Once, and this is gonna get personal, so apologies, I went to the wedding of an old college fling. Well, you know, not exactly a fling, but a little more serious than that. Okay, a lot more serious than that. And now, here's where it gets humiliating. Our first moment together in college was accompanied by someone at a party playing the song Purple Rain by Prince. And I will pause here while you snort derisively and judge me. Whatever, just whatever, just whatever. And what surprised me years later at the wedding was just how depressed I was. I mean, for all the obvious reasons I'm not going to bother going into, and for some I don't know you well enough to share, the whole thing just depressed me because, though by then I was a television writer and producer with some solid credits and a couple of TV series of my own, it was still weird and aching to realize that Off and On wasn't ever going to be on again. And then the wedding band started playing Purple Rain, and now do I have to pause again for you to snort and judge, or can you save it all up for when I'm done? Well, so even though I was a writer and a published author at the time, and I owned a fancy car and knew the difference between good dialogue and bad dialogue, I knew that this was the right moment to leave. "You're not leaving?" she asked. "Yes," I said, and pointed to the band playing Purple Rain. "This is where I came in."
I never meant to call you in your sorrow. I never meant to call you in your pain. I don't want to have you.
The Weekend Lover, Purple Rain, and Rob Long on Culture File. Here's a bit of Derek and Aina. That'll take the lovesick off you.
Aina, I want to ask you a question now, given that you're a great person to ask questions because you've always got the answers. You, as you would tell everybody, know everything. So, Aina, can you explain how we ended up with a non-native invasive species called the grey squirrel in Ireland?
Well, we did it because, as usual, we were aping our betters and we were aping the situation in Britain, because the Duke of Bedford in 1876 introduced grey squirrels to Woburn Park from North America. In those days, in the 1800s, the more things you brought from other countries, the more you could show off your wealth. They brought over trees, they brought over animals, they did all of these things thinking to show off to the locals how they were able to go abroad and bring back things and make up for the deficiencies in their own environment. So the Duke of Bedford brought these squirrels over to Woburn Park. He also brought them to Regent's Park and to Richmond Park, and he gave them to his friends and relations as well, so they too could share in this wonderful showing off. So as an article in the Irish Naturalist records at the time, in 1911, it was brought over to Castle Forbes in Ireland as a wedding present by the Duke of Buckingham, who was coming to a wedding of the gentry that lived in Castle Forbes. And he brought over a basket with squirrels, six pairs of squirrels, six pairs of grey squirrels. And they were then released when the wedding present was given. They tell us a photograph was taken of the very moment when it was laid before the bride and groom, and the lid opened and they leaped out and ran off into the woods. Wouldn't it be raging if you thought you were getting some kind of a picnic hamper and all you got was bloody squirrels which ran away? And from those six pairs, they have spread the length and breadth of the eastern half of Ireland. So it was a showing off job, as good as the neighbours, keeping up with the Joneses, totally showy off. And we've ended up then with this invasive species which outcompeted the reds, causes damage to our trees, and generally is a total nuisance and a pain, I have to say.
Aina ní Lána, not a woman to sit on the fence. Now, in the UK, there's talk of controlling the squirrel population using a contraceptive pill, but it's not an easy undertaking. Here's Richard Collins with Dr. Colin Lawton, lecturer in zoology in NUIG.
So this is permanent and irreversible. Once the squirrel has been sterilised effectively, she will never produce young again. Grey squirrels are not terribly territorial. They move around the place a lot. It seems to me that if you do this, you are unlikely to get all of them, are you? And if you are, it'll mean that a minority of females will have young successfully, and their young will be at a great advantage over the normal ones, because all the resources of the area will be available to them, whereas normally they would have to compete with others. Now, the kittens, there might be two broods of three, that's six young per year. Are you just sort of replacing one reproductive system with this reduced reproductive system? Is there any problem about that?
There's a lot of problems about it. Where this has been successful in the past, they've done it with large animals that are slow breeding, long-lived, and it's a much quicker system to, or an easier system to work in. But with the squirrels, they breed very quickly, as you say. They produce a lot of young. They actually produce more young than they need. And so you need to get an awful lot of individuals before you're going to have an effect. Now, whether you need to get 100% of them, or like the vaccines we're talking about with the coronavirus, whether a smaller percentage of the population will be enough to make a difference, that has to be seen.
From Mooney Goes Wild. Arena celebrated art and love on Tuesday night, and they spoke about one of Ireland's best known and best loved paintings, Helalil and Hildebrand, The Meeting on the Turret Stairs. It's an 1864 watercolour by Frederick William Burton. Here's art historian Jessica Fahey with Sean.
So it is in fact a watercolour, which is why it's only rarely on display, because it's quite fragile. And the romantic element of the subject, as tends to be the case in a Victorian artwork, is to have it somehow tragic. You know, so everyone, you know, usually is dead by the end of the story, and that somehow keeps them pure and keeps them chaste, which, of course, considered very important. So what we're looking at is a man and a woman meeting on a spiral staircase. She's going up the stairs, he's coming down. He's sort of holding her arm to his mouth as if he's kissing it, and she's turned away from him. So this is the last moment that they're ever going to see each other again. So it has that kind of, you know, poignant, tragic romance about it. But it's beautifully painted, exquisite details and a wonderful sort of vibrancy of colour. And it's very evocative of a kind of medieval romance in that particular time when we think about knights and maidens and fairy tales, really.
Well, that's just beautiful. Very romantic. Until Sean comes in with a dose of very bloody reality.
The brothers were sent off to kill everybody. Wasn't that the idea? The young woman's brothers?
Yeah, she had seven brothers. Yeah, yeah. And her father, who both are, so who all of them reacted against her relationship with this English prince. So she was a Danish princess. And he kills six of the brothers and the father, and doesn't kill the youngest because she asks him not to. And then he dies of his wounds, and then she dies of a broken heart.
Of course she does. Could she manage she after all of that?
Ooh, quite a grisly tale underneath the beauty. That was Arena on Tuesday night. Now, if you're looking for love in the middle of all this COVID, fair play. It's not easy. Morning Ireland's Joan O'Sullivan brought us this tale of Dublin-based Camelia, who went on a date. Socially distant, of course.
Like, I met someone a couple of weeks ago, and that he tried to hold my hand, and as a reflex, I said, ew, no COVID. And I never heard from him again.
Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. And this is To Celebrate Love in all its many and varied guises. Talk to you next week.